Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. Today we talk about climate change and land conservation. The state is facing many issues that impact the environment, including mining, grazing, water scarcity, and energy development. The last two summers have brought the biggest wildfires in the state's history, and we are facing yet another year of severe drought. Have you found innovative ways to incorporate conservation into your life? What does conservation look like in your community? And how can we balance improving our struggling economy in New Mexico with protecting our resources? How do you see your future in New Mexico, given the impacts of climate change? Join the conversation by calling 505-277-5866 or toll-free 866-899-5866. With us in the studio is Scott Wilbur, Executive Director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy, and KUNM Conservation Beat reporter Laura Paskus. And joining us by phone is William DeBuis, author of A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the Southwest. Thank you all for being here. Thank you, Scott. I want to start with you. Tell us briefly about the goals of the New Mexico Land Conservancy and how climate change has shifted the tenor of land conservation issues in New Mexico.
Sure. Well, we're a statewide nonprofit land trust. We work primarily with landowners, community organizations, and public agencies to conserve everything from wildlife habitat to productive agricultural land, scenic open space, recreational lands around the state. And our main goal is to increase both the quality and quantity of land conservation around New Mexico, to increase awareness about conservation and try to enhance appreciation for conservation throughout the state, and also to increase capacity both at the level of our organization but at the level of the larger conservation community within New Mexico.
And how does land conservation have an impact on climate change?
Well, as you know, we are in a very dry, arid part of the United States, and I mean, we've always been dealing with the climate, as far as I'm concerned, in New Mexico. But what we've really seen in the last few years is, you know, with temperature increases and water shortages, you know, it's having a huge impact on, you know, the health of the land, on the health of ecosystems, you know, wildlife. And so, you know, it's an issue that's always in the back of our minds. Conservation is a way that we can help mitigate some of those impacts from climate change.
And I'm going to bring in Bill. He's talking to us from his home in northern New Mexico. Bill, for those who have not read your book, could you briefly summarize the take-home message? What are the basic impacts of climate change now taking place in the Southwest?
Well, I guess what you want is the elevator speech for a 300-page book, which is a little tough to do.
I'm sorry.
Basically, the future we're looking at is going to be hotter and drier than the past. And it's going to be hotter because of the phenomenon of greenhouse gases and all the carbon pollution that we're pumping into the atmosphere. And it's going to be drier even if precipitation stays steady. And that's because the gradually rising mean temperatures that we're experiencing result in higher rates of evaporation. So hotter means drier. We can also expect more extreme events, extreme thunderstorms, extreme snowfall, extreme drought, extreme heat waves, et cetera. And we should expect those extreme events more often. So that's sort of the future that we're looking at, and the things that we need to keep in mind to do involve both mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation is to get a handle on this problem of greenhouse gas production, because there's no cap on how hot things can get. We've already got a lot of heat going into the system, and we could get as much as 8 degrees Fahrenheit hotter in mean temperature in the Southwest by the end of this century. We're just a little bit along the way toward that, on that journey into an overheated future, and we can already see big effects all around us.
You detail some of those in the book. What are some of the most profound that you saw when you're doing your research? Most profound effects?
Well, I think one of the things we all have observed is fire behavior having changed over the years. And one of the themes of the book is that no big thing happens for just one reason. The fire effects we see are also the artifact of over a century of fire suppression and the fuel buildup that has resulted from that. But the warming climate has also given us a fire season that's 78 days longer now, at least 78 days longer now than it was in the late 1970s and early 1980s, and conditions that are drier and hotter than those we experienced in the past. And so we've seen these gigantic blazes, the Whitewater Baldy Complex fire down in the Gila this year, the Las Conchas fire last year, and in a way what we're getting to see is the oxygen planet strutting its stuff and showing us what burning can really be.
Can I ask you and play devil's advocate for a minute? We've seen catastrophic droughts and impacts in this region for hundreds of years. There's pretty good evidence that caused larger native civilizations to disperse from places like Mesa Verde. And we had a multi-year drought in the 50s here in New Mexico. So why is this different?
Well, that's exactly right. There's always been drought in the Southwest. What's different now is that our droughts are hotter. And so with the greater heat, the moisture stress on plants and animals is much, much greater. One study looked at the drought of 1998, roughly, to 2004, and compared it to the drought of the 1950s, and found that it was 1 to 1.5 degrees Celsius hotter than the 1950s drought. So if you turn up the heat that much during a dry period, the effective dryness is much greater. And so the impacts on animals, plants, landscapes is heavier in less time.
Laura, I want to jump to you for a minute. You are a veteran environmental reporter. You're currently part of the conservation beat here at KUNM with me. What kind of shifts have you seen in conservation issues over the years, given these facts? How have they been impacted by climate change?
I think since I started reporting on the environment in 2002, which I don't know if I'm a veteran, but
that's a pretty long time,
is the urgency of covering climate change is much more urgent. We see these big forest fires. We see species on the brink of extinction. We see species that are migrating at different times. And for any of our listeners living in Albuquerque, you can drive over any one of the bridges over the Rio Grande. And this morning, when I drove over Rio Bravo, it looked more like a series of puddles than a river. I think the urgency is a really big issue. I've been waiting for 10 years to cover some sort of action from Congress on climate change, and that still hasn't happened. 10 years ago, the big issue was terrorism. We needed to focus on terrorism, not the environment, and now it seems like we have to focus on the economy, not the environment, so still kind of waiting to report on some congressional action.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because I remember not that long ago there was a lot more common ground on this. I specifically remember a series of national ads that had people like Newt Gingrich and Nancy Pelosi sitting on a couch on a beach together talking about climate change. And so are you seeing new division lines?
I'm not, to be honest, I'm just baffled at why it isn't more of for me, the environment and preparing for adapting to some of these changes that are already occurring and that are going to intensify just isn't a political issue. I'm just utterly baffled why it's such a divisive issue.
Have you, or I'll throw it out to any of our guests, have you seen the opposite of that? Have you seen any kind of new surprising partnerships or coalitions come together around this?
I have. One that's been interesting for me to watch is here on the Rio Grande, in the middle Rio Grande, as organizations, as people are, as the water scarcity situation becomes more serious and municipalities are looking for more water and buying water from agricultural communities, what I've seen in the past 10 years, which has been interesting, is environmental groups and farmers who 10 years ago were battling It was sort of this fish versus farmers issue on the river. I'm seeing more farmers and environmentalists coming together, trying to work together, and seeing water not moved upstream, for instance, to, say, Santa Fe or Albuquerque. And that's been really interesting to see.
Bill or Scott, do you see any surprising kind of groups working together that hadn't in the past because of the urgency of these things?
Well, I think, you know, in my line of work, I mean, we're working with all kinds of landowners, but primarily, you know, agricultural landowners. We do a lot of conservation on, you know, working farms and ranches. And so, you know, we have to be a little bit careful about the kind of terminologies we use.
Okay.
I mean,
because these are private landowners.
Exactly.
They've chosen this path.
And there, you know, frankly, are a lot of people in the agricultural community that aren't still completely convinced that you know, climate change is, in fact, human-induced. But I think, you know, we just have to focus on real issues that they deal with in their daily life. And, I mean, drought is real. You know, lower grass production is real. You know, lower, you know, water quantity. Those are all real issues. And so, you know, I've seen a number of groups, I mean, kind of pop up in the last few years that are trying to bring, you know, these different kinds of groups together. I mean, the Carrera Coalition is a good example of an organization that has managed to bring, you know, farmers and ranchers together with conservation groups and academics to, you know, talk about issues like sustainability on grasslands. You know, if you've gone to any of their conferences in the last few years, I mean, they've started to, you know, inject some discussion about things like, you know, climate change and, you know, approaching it in like a market-based way, you know, looking at, you know, ways that maybe ranchers could be compensated for storing, you know, banking carbon because, as we all know, I mean, vegetation stores carbon, you know, whether it's a grassland or a forest. So finding better ways to you know, maintain, you know, healthy systems, you know, do restoration work that increases the ability of the land to, you know, be productive, retain water, all those kinds of things. You know, our work is mainly the protection side. I mean, we're getting the easements in place. We're helping public agencies acquire land. But obviously there's that long-term stewardship that is what's going to ensure sustainability over the long term. And that's something that, you know, it's a never-ending job.
We already have a few callers, so I'm going to go to Judy in Albuquerque. Judy, welcome to the call-in show. What's your comment?
Thank you so much. I'm in a group called Our Endangered Aquifer Working Group, and we're concerned mostly about the contamination from Kirtland and from Sandia Labs that's now in the soil, and some of it has reached the aquifer. And there will be a hearing by a New Mexico Senate Interim Committee on November 8th, and we're inviting anyone who's concerned to meet with us and Agua Es Vida, Water Is Life, that group, on October 26th, Friday, from 6 to 8 p.m., to prepare to testify to the Senate committee, and it'll be at the Albuquerque Center for Peace and Justice on Silver and Harvard. And I just want to encourage concerned listeners to come with a scarcity of water to have this massive contamination on its way and some of it already in our aquifer is of great concern, and we encourage people to come and do what they can, which is testify.
Okay.
So, thank you.
Thanks, Judy. And they can find out more at the Peace and Justice Center in Albuquerque?
Correct.
Okay, and that's on October?
The preparation will be October 26th. That's to prepare for the hearings.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Glenn in Hemet Springs, welcome to the call-in show.
Thanks for the show. I have got about 5 points. The first is, when I moved in here about 11 years ago, my neighbor behind me said that we used to have a lot of snow here in Hemet Springs between November and March. She would even ski to work a mile away, no longer. My rose bush this last April, an elk completely wiped out all of the roses so early in the season. my apple trees, the deer and the elk, have been down the last month to trees throughout the area here. Or acacia or ditch water, I have to use that daily in my garden. This last summer, it was so hot, dried up. I couldn't make it one day without watering the next day. And then the ash in our river due to the Las Conchas fire, with the rainy season, the monsoon season, it just was so sad to look at that brown, blackish look, and I think it's probably killed fish. And then finally, my Republican friends that I deal with on this whole issue, I just don't understand it, as was said by one of your people there before. But then I got to thinking, there are so many things we can do, and I think it threatens our lavish lifestyle of waste. If we think about having to cut back on our use of cars and trucks and scale down, and maybe with this whole push for more jobs and keeping the economy going, it's a real threat to people to have to think of conservation. Thank you so much for your show.
Thank you so much, Glenn. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're going to go to a break and come back, but you can call in at 277-5866 or 866-899-5866.
The 5th Albuquerque Cultural Conference, Crossing Borders, Personal, Regional, International, opens with performance poetry at the Outpost Friday, September 28th at 7 p.m. On Saturday and Sunday, the 29th and 30th at Harwood Arts Center, panels address educational freedom, community ownership and culture, and community writing. Special guests include Luis Rodriguez, Irene Vasquez, and Sandra Soto. Register at albuquerqueculturalconference.org. A message from the tax-exempt West End Press.
And we're back. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking conservation and climate change this morning. You can join the conversation at 277-5866 or toll-free 866-899-5866. Bill, Glenn brings up some interesting points, just the observations he's noticed in Jemez Springs echoes a lot of the impacts you write about in your book, A Great Aridness. Did you find more people moving to the Southwest has been the case historically, or are these issues causing that to slow? I mean, will we see the kind of environmental-based migrations we've seen in the developing world as water scarcity worsens? A lot of people aren't necessarily native to here. It depends on how deep their ties are to New Mexico.
Well, there has been a slowing down of people moving to the Southwest, but that's more a result of the Great Recession that we're in and, you know, the popping of the housing bubble that began in 2007 and really got bad in 2008 and 2009. So it remains to be seen whether the fevered growth to the Sun Belt is going to resume in full force as the housing issue and the economy get back on track. Eventually, we will see people moving. We're already seeing people moving around the world driven by climate change. India is building a wall, a big fence against Bangladesh. It's worried about people moving out of there, especially as sea levels rise and storm surges are more powerful. Morocco is worried about people from the West Sahara, and Spain is worried about people from Morocco. Egypt is concerned about people from the Sudan moving north. These are the kinds of things we're going to see all over the world.
Okay. I want to take another call from Leslie in Albuquerque. Leslie?
Good morning.
Hi. You wanted to talk about slowing population, which kind of ties into the things we've just been talking about.
Absolutely, but I haven't heard enough discussion about it over the last maybe 30 years. 30 to 35 years ago, it seems to me there was a great push for people to be aware of the population explosion that was going to come, and it's here. And there's been absolutely no talk about it in my, I haven't read or seen anything about it in months, years, days, whatever. Let's bring it back to the fore. I guess one of the problems is that certain groups are anti-abortion, and I hate to bring that up right now. But we have to have one or the other. The Earth can't sustain the amount of population that is growing. And I thank you. I hope your guests have comments on this.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask Bill and Scott, Laura, if you want to jump in. I often hear from people, I moved here 8 years ago, who would be perfectly happy if no one else moved to New Mexico. And this kind of, I think that kind of sentiment ties in here because they say we can't afford the impacts of that growth on our state. But we're also a poor state. We desperately need jobs, especially if people want their children to be able to stay here. So can we balance these things wisely? Bill, do you have any thoughts on that?
Somehow we have to find a way to move to a steady state economy. As Ed Abbey said, the continuous growth is the ideology of the cancer cell. And we cannot keep growing in population, and especially in resource consumption, without breaking the bank, as it were. One thing to remember in talking about population, though, is that it's not just numbers of people, but also rates of consumption. The Earth might be able to support 9 billion people if folks lived at the level of consumption of the people in Laos today. But if everybody's going to live like Americans, then we're not going to make it.
Do you guys have any other comments on that?
I agree with Bill, and just we just go crazy with our resource use. Our water use is out of control. I think that Santa Fe has tried to address the conservation and balancing conservation with economic growth. I'm not an expert on this by any means, but it doesn't seem to me like Santa Fe is really struggling economically. I know there's a housing slowdown, but they've done a really good job. That city's done a really good job with water conservation and prioritizing water conservation as something that should be important to people.
Now, Bill, I know in your book you make a provocative argument that water conservation can actually make things worse. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a phenomenon called demand hardening. If everybody conserves, the question is, when you conserve, what happens to the water that you save? If that water simply goes to the next strip mall or the next housing development down the road, then pretty soon you have more people on the same amount of water, and let's say everybody is conserving and using only what they absolutely need, and that makes room for still more people, and eventually you have all your water being used very, very economically, let's say, but at that point you have no flex in the system. If supply drops, if serious drought comes, how do you cut back? Because everybody is now using only what they absolutely need. The key to effective conservation is to be able to use the conserved water to increase, not decrease drought resilience, and to put that water somehow in some kind of a reserve that will back up the community when time gets tough.
So it's like an actual savings account.
That's right. And different communities approach this different ways, but nobody's really cracked this problem completely, and it's a very thorny one.
Well, there's a caller has a question about water rates. Francis in Albuquerque, welcome to the call-in show.
Hi. I guess that my question sort of flows from this, and that my understanding is that Albuquerque has one of the lowest water rates in the country, and I'm wondering if that wouldn't help. I mean, it seems like money speaks louder than anything else. I don't know if there are any efforts or, you know, why haven't there been greater efforts to increase the water rates to help with incentivizing, you know, conservation, and especially in Albuquerque. I can't speak to any other city.
I'll throw that out to any of our guests. Anyone like to comment?
I think we've talked about that in our newsroom before. Carrie Young did a great story about a month or two ago about water conservation, looking at the rates. And I think Santa Fe's rates are a lot higher than Albuquerque's. And they have been more successful than Albuquerque in conserving water. Albuquerque has done a good job in the past year or a few years. But from my perspective, it seems like there should be some sort of where the rates are depending on how much you use. If you're a household and you don't use a lot, you shouldn't be paying a ton. But if you're a large business or a large water user, maybe those rates should be higher.
Okay. And I want to go to Bill in Los Lunas. He has a question about fire suppression. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, good morning. Your author claim that fire suppression was a problem. Fire suppression, the theory, is prevention. Accumulation of fuel in the forest is due to restrictions of removal of that fuel. That's the problem. Forest fires are also manipulated by man to bring out the main lumber industry into provision. So it's important to understand that man has a lot to do with destroying the forest through fire. Even if it's a fire that started by lightning, they let the fire run, like the governor did with the biggest fire in our history. She hired private helicopters to put out the fire at a cost of $11 million to the taxpayer, and there was two civil defense helicopters designed to fight fires sitting in the tarmac that would have cost $6 million. So she had a lot to do to create the biggest fire in the history of mankind. Since the beginning of time, mankind has planted the seeds of war to manipulate and destroy the growth of truth, transparent truth. Since mankind has manipulated and destroyed Mother Earth through rape and greed, at the end, mankind will destroy, consume mankind.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Bill, do you have any thoughts on fire suppression's role in conservation? I should say, Scott or Bill, when we're talking about land conservation, this fire suppression has been rather controversial in how it's done, whether it's effective. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, you've got to distinguish between sort of the fire suppression that is part of normal management and the fire suppression that you need to call into play when really big blazes break out and property has to be protected and so forth. But the bottom line, that before extensive settlement in the Southwest, there were many frequent low-intensity fires, especially in our ponderosa and mixed conifer zones. And those low-intensity fires kept the forest thinned out and kept fuel from building up to very high amounts. With the suppression of all fire, any kind of fire, for the most part, over the last century and some years, the fuel, the saplings, the down timber, the fallen branches, all that stuff has been able to build up to levels that create the equivalent out there of fire bombs. Once they're ignited, there's not much you can do except stand back and get out of the way. The caller is quite right that how we have managed timber production and timber extraction has influenced all these things, but it's not a simple business that we should have cut more timber or that we should have cut less. The dynamics of fire and fuel buildup are pretty complicated, and I guess that's enough for now.
Okay. Scott, can I ask, when your organization, the Land Conservancy, it helps owners create land trusts, including lifelong ranchers with large holdings. So when you have a land trust or a conservancy, what actually happens on it? Is it just there's no impacts, or they decide how much access happens with it, or what kinds of activities take place?
Well, basically what we're doing through a conservation easement is putting a kind of permanent deed restriction on the property to limit subdivision and develop of the land primarily. But obviously, you know, easements are flexible agreements that we negotiate on a case-by-case basis with the landowners, depending on, you know, the land, their conservation objectives, and the, you know, the thresholds that we have as a conservation organization for holding those easements. So, you know, reducing subdivision development is the main goal, but we can also, you know, focus on different kinds of land management through the easement. Although, you know, typically, you know, we're not trying to interfere too much in the, you know, day-to-day operations of a private landowner's operations. We work with a lot of farmers and ranchers, and easements do allow them to continue practicing a lot of those kind of traditional activities like farming, ranching, you know, limited timber harvesting. You know, compatible recreational uses. We're just trying to make sure that, you know, those activities occur in a manner that don't significantly negatively impact the conservation values that we're trying to protect under those easements.
Okay. I'm going to go to Clifton in Albuquerque. He has a question about a politician who lost because of his support for the fiscal arguments for conservation.
Yeah, I saw this actually from NPR. You guys may have heard about it. A guy named Iglesias who lost his support from the Republican Party. Among other things, he said it's not conservative to waste stuff. Talks about how his dad taught him how to get better gas mileage by letting off on the gas pedal. And he says it's not conservative to send somebody else's kid to fight for stuff we're wasting. And his whole point, of course, is that there's a fiscal argument which, you know, resonates well with conservatives, that we don't have to provide subsidies for solar and wind, etc., if we eliminate subsidies for coal, oil, gas, etc. And I did also want to make people aware of James Kunstler's book, The Long Emergency, in which he describes a lot of the migration that will occur as a result of increasing fuel costs. He, for example, paints a scary picture for Phoenix that relies so much on fuel for air conditioning, and when fuel costs go up, that may not bode well for Phoenix. Thank you.
Thank you, Clifton. Scott, do you have any thoughts about, in terms of how land conservation might impact things like what Clifton is talking about? Because it seems like an idea that is more people could get behind because it has a free market basis. You know, it's not quite as divisive as some other environmental issues.
Yeah, I mean, the whole beauty of our private land conservation movement is that it is voluntary. You know, it doesn't involve a takings. You know, landowners agree to enter into these agreements voluntarily and can receive, you know, pretty substantial forms of tax and financial compensation in the process. Here in New Mexico, we're really fortunate to have a state tax credit program for private landowners that donate land for conservation purposes. And that's supplemented by a federal tax deduction that's been in place for many years. So, you know, when they put these agreements into place, the value essentially of the development rights that they're giving up through these easements can be appraised, and they receive tax incentives for those, you know, the development rights that they're giving up.
And you guys, you were the recipient of rancher Jane Pachesky, I believe, donated a 262-acre ranch to the Land Conservancy several years ago. And so you're giving the first award that you've created in her name, is that right? Or the first time you've given the award to our other guest, Bill DuBois.
Yes.
Event coming up.
Yeah, we're actually celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. We were founded in 2002, and the gift that you mentioned of the Pachesky Ranch was granted to us about 3.5 years ago by Jane Pachesky, who had been a longtime resident of Santa Fe. She and her husband ran a store called the Old Guarantee on the plaza, and we're very involved with horses. Jean, her husband, was actually a co-founder of the Santa Fe Rodeo, and they lived kind of on the outskirts of the city in the 60s, out where the mall is now, and saw the city growing out. And so they wound up moving to the other side of I-25 into what's now called the Community College District, and had a horse ranch out there for a number of years. And Jean passed away in 2001, and Jane continued to live out there. And she was always very, very involved in both land and water conservation issues in Santa Fe and at the statewide level. And she decided in 2004 to put an easement on her ranch. And then part of her estate planning, she wound up donating the entire property to us in 2009. And she moved into El Castillo Retirement Center in Santa Fe and continued to come out and visit us for a couple of years. We actually got her named as a Santa Fe Living Treasure in 2010, kind of recognizing her lifetime of philanthropic work and good community service. And unfortunately, she passed away in early 2011. And we had been thinking for a long time about, you know, what kind of a signature event that we could do to continue to honor her and her legacy. And so we've decided to start this conservation award in her name. And we are giving that award at an event at Bishop's Lodge in Santa Fe on October 12th to Bill DeBuies, kind of recognizing his long-term contributions to conservation in New Mexico. Maybe Bill can talk a little bit more about those, but you know, he was the executive director up at the Valles Caldera when that was first put together, and was behind the formation of the Valle Grande Grass Bank, and was involved with the founding of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. So you know, in addition to being a very well-recognized author, he has, you know, the on-the-ground experience, and so that's what we're going to recognize in October.
Before I go to Bill, I just want to remind you this is the KUNM Call-In Show, and I'm Megan Kamrick. You can join the conversation at 277-5866 or 866-899-5866. Bill, you are being honored with this award, and what's your perception in terms of what people like private landowners like Jane Pachesky, how important is that when we're talking climate change?
Well, first I want to say it's a great honor to be receiving the Pachesky Award, and I just hope that Scott and his colleagues got the right guy. you know, private landowners are absolutely vital to land conservation. And, in fact, Aldo Leopold, in one of his less widely distributed but most important essays, pointed this out. You know, so much of the land in the United States is in private hands, the vast majority of it. And unless private landowners take care in the stewardship of land, then we're not going to be able to preserve the unity and the vibrancy and the productivity of the landscapes we depend on. And so the action of someone like Jane Pachesky, or any number of other supporters and collaborators with land trusts around the state, is absolutely vital to preserving the beauty and the integrity of New Mexico.
Well, we have a number of callers, and we'll go to just after a break. This is the KUNM Call-In Show, and you can participate by calling 277-5866 or toll-free 866-899-5866. We're talking with William DeBuies, author of A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the Southwest, Scott Wilbur, Executive Director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy, and Conservation Beat Reporter at KUNM. Here is Laura Paskus. We'll be back right after this break.
Donating to Goodwill means keeping it local, accepting donations of gently used items at locations in Albuquerque, Rio Rancho, and Santa Fe to support programs helping New Mexicans overcome barriers to employment. Online at goodwillit.org. A message from the tax-exempt Goodwill Industries of New Mexico.
We promise we'll stop the pledge drive the minute we receive $299,000. With about a month to go, listeners have already given $50,000. That's terrific. Maybe they want to win the ukulele or one of the other great prizes, or perhaps they just love the idea of ending the pledge drive early, or both. What's your reason? Return your response card today so it's sure to reach us before the first prize drawing, or register and give at KUNM.org. Thanks so much.
And we're going to go to the phones. Dave from Albuquerque, what is your question for our guests on the call-in show?
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank you for doing a great show on a very important topic, and thank our guests. I think the Land Conservancy does do great work in our state, and obviously Mr. DeBuies is kind of one of our state treasures, so thanks for having them on. So climate change obviously means immense challenges to our state, and potentially has enormous cost to our state as well. So it seems to me that being proactive and being as flexible as possible to respond to it is kind of our best bet. And it's going to take local, state, and federal responses, as well as, you know, citizens doing their part. So my question for your guests is, what is our state government doing to be proactive and try to encourage flexibility and resiliency in response to climate change, maybe particularly on land conservation, since I think that's the guest's area of most expertise. So, you know, what's our state doing? What's the administration and or the legislature doing, or what could they do to better prepare us for climate change? And, you know, working or incentivizing landowners, et cetera, seems to be part of it. But I'll hang up and listen to their responses on the air, and thanks again.
Okay, thank you very much, Dave. Scott or Bill, anyone want to jump in?
Sure, yeah, I'll jump in. And I recognize the caller, Dave Simon, former State Parks Director, with whom we worked on some different projects while he was in office. I think, as we're all aware, I mean, you know, we're in a very different kind of both economic and political climate than we were a few years ago. You know, when I first came to New Mexico in 2004, you know, Governor Richardson was initiating, you know, a number of very pro-conservation programs, ranging from helping us get the state tax credit in place that I mentioned through the Land Conservation Incentives Act. You know, that was created in 2004, and then it was actually expanded in 2008. We also worked on a piece of legislation called the Natural Conservation Heritage Act, which actually created a funding mechanism within the Department of Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources for conservation and restoration. And Governor Richardson was able to come up with some initial seed funding that enabled us to complete a number of conservation easement projects. And when I say we, not just the New Mexico Land Conservancy, but the larger land trust community, you know, which includes, you know, national organizations like the Nature Conservancy Trust for Public Land, as well as local trusts like, you know, Taos Land Trust, Santa Fe Conservation Trust. I mean, there's a whole community of land conservation organizations that very much depend on that kind of state support, particularly to have, you know, funding available to compensate a lot of these kind of land-rich, cash-poor landowners. I mean, that's what we're dealing with here in New Mexico, especially in the agricultural community, is, you know, you talk about landowners that may be willing to put an easement in place that has a value of potentially, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or even millions of dollars. And, you know, simple tax deductions alone aren't always enough to motivate them to take that step of doing an easement. So by having that combination of incentives, you know, tax credits combined with funding, it just further enables us to do the work that we do. And we worked very closely with the Energy, Minerals, and Natural Resources Department for a number of years, and, you know, the Game and Fish Department and State Forestry. You know, there's a number of programs that also receive federal funding, and by having those state resources, we can access more of those federal dollars. I mean, that's always been a challenge here in New Mexico, is we're just not getting our share of the federal pie, and so. You know, one of the things looking to the future that I think we really need is some dedicated recurring state funding. I mean, if you look at the state of Colorado, for example, through their Great Outdoors Colorado program, which is funded through the lottery, they generate $35 to $40 million a year, which enables them to leverage significant federal resources. So there's a group of conservation organizations that have been working on trying to, you know, look at different funding mechanisms and then eventually develop a campaign for a statewide conservation funding initiative.
So you can go ahead, Laura.
Oh, I just wanted to add that to what Dave was asking about, also how the state was meeting the challenges and how they could. I think under Governor Richardson, during the Bush administration, there was such a lack of action on climate change, even from the Environmental Protection Agency, that New Mexico and a number of other states really felt like if there was anything that was going to happen on climate change, it had to start happening at a state level. And so Governor Richardson really pushed the Environment Department to be studying the impacts of climate change, the economic impacts, public health impacts. There were task forces. You know, there was talk of cutting carbon emissions within the state and addressing climate change, and that has all ended in the Martinez administration. At the same time that the issues are becoming more urgent, New Mexico has really stepped back from becoming a leader on climate change. And one of the things that's been most disappointing to me is to see there were a number of people within the Environment Department who were real leaders on the issue of climate change who are no longer there or who have been moved into different positions. And I think right now the big where we can maybe hope for or expect some sort of action is if within the New Mexico State Legislature there are some leaders who step up and say we need to be preparing for water scarcity, we need to be really addressing these big problems for the future.
I'm going to go. We have a few callers waiting, so I'm going to jump in and make sure we get them in. Chris in Albuquerque, tell us what you're experiencing. It has to do with chickens.
Yeah, first of all, I did want to thank you for having the Trust for Public Land, New Mexico Land Conservancy, and these organizations who educate the public about land land easements, conservation easements, because they're a really, really important part of our puzzle here on how to fix what's wrong with our environment. Secondly, I'm an urban chicken farmer. I have five chickens, and I raise my own eggs, as do many people around Albuquerque. And this summer had a drastic decrease in egg production. I went to a social event with a number of other local farmers, and a lot of people mentioned that, gee, they're just not, you know, it's just way down egg production, and we also had an unusually hot summer. So I'm not a scientist. I don't know what studies there are about this, but as someone who's been a conservationist for 30 years or so, for me, it didn't hit home until it was my food basket. And there's such a disconnect with we go to the store, you know, we drive, we go to the grocery store, we drive home. We're so disconnected from where our food comes from that I think that having more local farming, having schools and children and people actually recognizing where their food comes from, having people raising their own chickens and seeing that, oh, the temperature's higher, my chickens aren't laying, I can't eat. We need parallels like that. We need to be less disconnected from our environment and have it at home, you know, beyond the intellectual discussion. So okay. That was my point.
Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. And Jennifer, in Santa Fe, you moved here from Oklahoma. And tell us about that. And you said where the weather is so extreme, and mean in Oklahoma it was so extreme?
Our family moved to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, last year from Oklahoma. And we had some discussion about possibly moving back, but in the end, we decided that we would not, because the weather in Oklahoma has become so extreme, it was to the point that it was miserable. In the summer times, it's not unusual anymore for the temperature to be 110, even 113 degrees, not for single days during the summer, but for weeks at a time. Sometimes they'll go 6-8 weeks in those kinds of temperatures. And it was at the point where it was impacting my family's health. My son was, and I both have asthma, and we were on medication throughout the summer because it was just, it was very, very challenging for our bodies to handle that. And you begin to have everyday fears as parents. You know, if I send my child to camp today, are they going to be safe? Because they're forecasting that it's going to be 110 degrees again. And it became a real issue for us. So at this point, we've decided that we probably will never move back. And in fact, there was some discussion in my family who came to visit us in the midst of the heat of Oklahoma and came here, and it was 85 degrees, and they couldn't believe it. They were in shock that in the middle of summer it was so temperate here. And I understand here people are saying it's getting hotter, but in Oklahoma it's almost beyond the point of bearability for many people. And I think that as it continues like that, more people are going to move. They're going to leave that environment.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jennifer. And we're just going to go quickly to Dan in Belen. You had a question about the Chimney Rock presidential designation.
Hi, this is Dan. I'll make it quick because I want to hear from the panelists. So last week the president designated Chimney Rock as a national monument. I know Senators Bingaman and Udall and Representatives Heinrich and Lujan have worked hard on things like Rio Grande del Norte here in New Mexico near Taos and the Oregon Mountains down in Las Cruces area. I would like the panelists to maybe handicap what we think, whether we think we're going to maybe get a bill or maybe get a presidential designation here in New Mexico so we can celebrate a national monument here, because all the benefits that it brings.
Okay. Thanks, Dan. Well, we're approaching the end of the show, so let's quickly address Dan's question. What do any of you think about what our chances of getting this designation?
I would guess we won't get a bill, or we won't get a bill passed, but I can't even guess about a presidential designation. Sorry.
Okay. Bill, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a little bit that the president can do by executive order, but as Laura points out, the big conservation agenda, the federal agenda for New Mexico, requires congressional action. And getting a land bill through our deadlocked Congress these days is next to impossible. somehow we've got to find a way to elect a Congress that will actually do the people's business.
Okay. Bill, also, I was reading, Laura did a review of your book in High Country News and said it's not an optimistic book. So I wanted to ask if that's a fair characterization and ask all of you as we're winding down, are you optimistic? Is there a place to be optimistic?
Well, I'll tell you, in the course of doing the book, I realized that I was an intellectual pessimist. The future is grim, but a neurochemical optimist. The sunrise is beautiful. And I think as long as there's beauty out there, there's something to defend, and it behooves all of us to become involved in defending the beauty of our state and of this gorgeous planet, and to work to solve some of these very difficult problems.
What about you, Scott?
I'm definitely an optimist. You know, I got into this field about 15 years ago because, from my perspective, land trust work, private land conservation work, is, I mean, it's a very tangible thing. You can really see the results on the ground. I mean, I appreciate all the great work that all the advocacy groups are doing out there, like NRDC and EDF, and, you know, fighting for better policies in the trenches. But for me, it was kind of a personal choice. And, you know, every day through the work I do, I mean, I come into touch with, you know, just incredible private landowners that want to do the right thing on their land. And, you know, what better legacy to leave than, you know, a legacy of conserved, you know, well-stewarded, you know, restored, managed land. So, you know, we just hit the 100,000-acre mark this year of conserved land around the state. And we've set out a pretty ambitious goal to get to 1 million acres. You know, within the next 25 years. And that's, you know, that's, again, that's not something that we see ourselves doing by alone. I mean, it's going to require a lot of collaboration, not only with other organizations from the land conservation community, but, you know, a broader array of collaborations. And that's why I think it's so important, you know, that, you know, we need to bring people to the table and look for, you know, solutions. You know, you can dwell on this stuff every day and get really depressed about it. But we've got to keep looking for solutions. We've got to realize that we're a big part of the problem, and we need to be a big part of the solution. And there are very tangible things that people can do.
What struck me about our last callers is the personal experiences and how mm-hmm. powerful those are, because I think otherwise this can be very abstract, very overwhelming, or just not seem to be part of your life, right? So is there – I mean, how we all kind of want yeah. the same things, right? Healthy communities, healthy families, beautiful places.
I think so. I mean, I report on, like, the most depressing issues ever, and I'm incredibly optimistic because what I see time and time again is communities and individuals who love something. They love the river. They love the land. They love the landscape of New Mexico. They love their communities. They love their children, and they want to protect these areas and have something. And I think that's what makes me feel excited. And, you know, I see the work that some of the tribal communities are doing, or the Acequia communities, activists who show up time and time again to a public meeting, people who really care about these things. And I think the personal connection is huge. And the more that we can connect our children and have them excited about nature and being outside and learning and exploring, and we should all be supporting science education in our schools, because our children are the ones who are going to be dealing with these problems that we've pretty much dropped the ball on.
Well, I appreciate you all being here on the KUNM Call-In Show. Today we discussed climate change and land conservation. And in the studio we had Laura Paskus, fellow conservation beat reporter with the KUNM News Department, along with me, and Scott Wilbur, the executive director of the New Mexico Land Conservancy. And by phone we were joined by William DeBuise, author of A Great Aridness, Climate Change and the Future of the Southwest. I appreciate you all being here. Thanks for all the calls. And you can hear the program in its entirety later this morning on KUNM.org. And you can also post your comments there. Our call screeners today were Andy Lyman and Michael Hess. Roman Garcia engineered the program. I'm Megan Kamerick. And join us next week at the same time for the KUNM Call-In Show.